From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard Magazine. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal. And here are the issues. Four American swimmers at the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro were accused of involvement in an early morning altercation that angered Brazilians and ballooned into an international incident. One of the swimmers, Ryan Lochte, a gold medal winner, claimed they had been robbed at gunpoint, a statement Rio police said was untrue. U.S. Olympic officials apologized for the incident and did not defend Lochte's statement. In the American presidential race, Donald Trump hired a new team to run his campaign against Hillary Clinton. Meanwhile, Russian planes flew from an airbase in Iran on a bombing mission against Syrian rebels. And in Turkey, the crackdown following a failed military coup continued. The Olympics. Now, who thought, Tom, we'd be talking about the Olympics in this manner? This incident, I'm afraid, at least for a day or two, has overshadowed really the great athletics that goes on in the Olympics. I've certainly been watching a lot of it, and I've watched a lot more volleyball than I normally would. Anyway, what do you make of this incident? It seems like there's no good explanation for the conduct of the American swimmers.
No, there is none, Fred. I mean, it looks like they all had had too much to drink, or several of them, and it also is very clear, established, I think, beyond a reasonable doubt by surveillance video cameras, that the story that the American swimmers, especially Ryan Lochte, told police about being robbed at gunpoint with a robber pointing a gun to his head was just a fabrication. And you're right, it is a real blemish on what would have to be acknowledges has been a sterling U.S. performance in the Olympics, probably one of the strongest ever.
And so, especially in swimming.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the last time I looked, they had something like 25 swimming medals. Very, very strong. But this is an embarrassment to the U.S., to the U.S. Olympic Committee, which has apologized. One of the swimmers who did not make up the story has apparently done a plea bargain with Brazilian authorities where he's going to pay $11,000 to a foundation and be allowed to leave the country. But it is certainly an embarrassment, to put it mildly.
You know, Brazilians, David, are obviously sensitive. Remember, they won the Olympics 7 or 8 years ago, I forget exactly, when their economy was really booming and their economy's in a recession now and it's not so great. And all the stories leading up to the Olympics were, gee, they'll never be able to pull this off and so on. And yet they've done a pretty good job, I think. And now this.
That's right. And I think you've put your finger on why this is more than just a bunch of young guys drinking too much and behaving badly. It's that their cover story was fitted absolutely into every cliche about crime-ridden, out-of-control, badly-run third-world countries that don't know how to host something like the Olympic Games. And I think that one of the really interesting things you've seen about the Olympic movement in the last several sort of games is there's a real split where actually it's getting harder and harder to persuade rich world cities to host the Olympic Games. Boston here in the States basically decided halfway through a bid for the Olympics that it didn't want to host them, it didn't want to have them. And so there's a sense that it's actually countries like China, it's countries like Brazil that feel they're rising powers that have something to prove, that are the kind of countries that want to host the Olympics. And then you have the big established kind of superpowers like the US saying, well, you know, your swimming pool water in the diving pools turned bright green, what's up with that? Or the water in the harbour is, you know, so dirty that it's making the sailors sick. So there's a real sense of kind of rich world versus poor world that comes together in these Olympic Games now.
Yeah, no, that's too bad. There, you know, it looked like earlier there were a couple of incidents, small incidents, really. There was one where an Israeli wrestler defeated an Egyptian wrestler and the Egyptian refused to shake his hands afterwards. That got some attention. And then there were that finger wagging, remember, between the Russian swimmer who I think had been in the past had taken performance in enhancing drugs against the American swimmer, and they had a little mild dispute. But this is a big deal. I mean, I think the U.S. is going to be apologizing for this for a long time.
And I suspect before it's all over, Fred, that the U.S. Olympic Committee is going to have to impose some sort of sanctions on these swimmers. I don't know exactly what. Nobody's going to take their medals away, but it was certainly not ugly American is the phrase that leaps to mind.
Well, that does come to mind for sure. But David, I'm going to give you the last word. What about this notion that the non huge, prosperous, industrialized nations, the idea that they have an advantaged position here. They have more money, they can train athletes for a long time, and yet these poorer countries really can't do that, although in some cases they do remarkably well. I think of the Kenyan runners.
Yeah, or the Jamaican sprinters.
And the Jamaican sprinters, of course.
And Ethiopia. No, mm-hmm. I think it is, I mean, I think one of the things you see each Olympic cycle, and it gets more intense each time, is can you sit down with your kids in front of this thing and say, this is a celebration of international peace, brotherhood, and idealism? Or, you know, how distracted are we now by each wave of scandals? Let's not forget that the Russian track and field team was banned as it went into mm-hmm. this third sort of mm-hmm. state-controlled doping. So is there any kind of idealism in international sport left? Or is it all, as you say, a competition between mm-hmm. who has the money, who has the, mm-hmm. the doping program?
Yeah, no, I think there's some left, but less. Okay.
Yes.
Let's turn to the American presidential campaign. And Donald Trump now has his third campaign team. I think it's his third one. You know, Corey Lewandowski and then Paul Manafort. Now these new people, Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway, a pollster. Bannon and Conway are quite different, actually. She's a professional pollster, and he's
professional flamethrower.
I was going to say bomb thrower, but anyway, we're in the same ballpark here. And yet, coming out of that, he hired him, I don't know, a few days ago. Trump makes an apology, a vague apology, for having misspoken and insulted people in the past. I think he'll have to follow that up if he wants to be serious about it and actually cite some examples. And if he needs any, I can send him some. But what about this? What about the Trump campaign? Should we expect a more disciplined, a smarter, a Trump that sticks to the issues and blah, blah, blah?
Perhaps. Perhaps this is a good start, but you know, Fred, you and I have covered campaigns a long time, and you may remember that in the glory days of Newsweek, when I was a White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, the editors at Newsweek had this phrase that they loved to use to depict this sort of maneuvering mm-hmm. and chaos and mm-hmm. internal confusion. They called it scuffling in the wheelhouse. And of course, reporters love scuffling in the wheelhouse because it's got news energy.
Of course they do. I love it.
But I would say on a serious note that, or a semi-serious note, that in my experience, and this is my 13th presidential election, scuffling in the wheelhouse doesn't end well. Because yeah. I thought Dan Baltz, the venerable chief political correspondent for the Washington Post, had a wonderful phrase when he was writing about this. He talked about these changes smacking of desperation more than just a normal pivot and transition mm-hmm. from a mm-hmm. primary campaign where Trump was extraordinarily successful to a general election, which has a whole different set of expectations mm-hmm. and circumstances mm-hmm. and requirements. And so, I mean, it's clearly a pivot. It's clearly a refocus. The real question is, can Donald Trump be different while returning to his roots? He said, since this, I have to be me. Trump has yeah. to be Trump, and I'm going to be Trump, but we will have to see how that plays out.
The most apologizing, though, is not Trump.
No,
that's not when you think of the real Trump.
That tells you the least that somebody in the new chain of command mm-hmm. has said to him, you've got to do something here. You've got to, yes, mm-hmm. you've got to behave. You've got to stop mm-hmm. speaking off the cuff so much, but you've got to express some regret. Let's see where that goes.
Mm-hmm. David, Trump is behind in all the polls, 5, 6, 7 points, 8 points nationally. The states he needs, like Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida, he's behind in all of those. Hillary Clinton seems to be somewhat coasting, actually, I would say. Look, I don't think the race is over, but Trump's in pretty bad shape.
Well, I think what's fascinating about what we're seeing right now is sometimes when you have your fantastic phrase about, you know, scuffling the wheelhouse, sometimes that's because there's a genuine difference of opinion about what's the way to win. The mm-hmm. candidate has a theory of the case mm-hmm. that his strategy involves, you know, this state, that state, turnout, you know, in this group or whatever. It doesn't seem to be that with Trump. It's that when you give Trump the kind of sensible, disciplined speech that his advisors think he needs to start making, mm-hmm. it's not that he thinks that it's politically, you know, unwise. It's that he's bored.
Yeah.
He doesn't mm-hmm. enjoy giving those kind of speeches. And when you see him giving one of these speeches,
he thinks the crowd, he has said that he thinks the crowds will start dwindling.
And his great mistake is to mistake the crowd in front of him with the electorate that he needs to actually carry him over the line. Mm-hmm. And it's as if someone can't explain the basic maths that there's two elections. You win the Republican candidacy, the nomination, with the Republican primary electorate, and that's, I can't remember, the total number is like 28 million people voted in the primary this year. But to get to the White House, to get to that big desk, you need 65 million votes. It's a different electorate.
Yeah. You know, somehow Trump and some of his advisors think that the big turnout of crowds is an indication, a reflection of what can happen in the general election. And, you know, Tom, you and I have been doing these elections long enough. God, I remember the huge crowds for Walter Mondale, the Democrat running against Ronald Reagan in 1984, and he lost by 19 points.
I remember in 1992, I've never forgotten something that Marlon Fitzwater, who was President George H.W. Bush's press secretary, said after Bush lost to Bill Clinton. He said, "We were amazed we lost because the crowds in the last week were unbelievable. The biggest crowds of the campaign, the biggest crowds of President Bush's presidency. We just were convinced that we were over the top." And it's not, David is exactly right. It's not the crowds. It's what's happening in swing states, in battleground states, and get out the vote and all sorts of things.
And some fascinating signs that some big voter blocs, you know, we thought that American politics was becoming increasingly fossilized, that the camps were becoming more and more divided, that it was a red America and a blue America. But if you look at some of the polls, if they continue to see the same results, there was some very interesting stuff this week coming out of polls where you compare opinion polls taken before the big national conventions, the Democrat and the Republican, huge kind of gatherings we just had in the summer. And you compare the polls taken before and after those gatherings, and there have been some huge shifts among groups like educated white women, women with college degrees. I mean, 4 million of them shifted into the Hillary Clinton camp. Right. And these were women who have, you know, been pretty much evenly divided between the two parties. A lot of them were Republican voters, particularly the married ones, particularly the slightly older ones. They looked at the best shot that Trump had at selling his case to the Republican National Convention, and they marched in the other direction.
I want to read you a headline on a story that came out a couple of days ago by Mike Barone, who's been around. He was a pollster. He used to be a liberal, now a conservative. But anyway, here's the headline of the piece. "Today's candidates don't measure up to Roosevelt or Reagan." I think we'd agree with that. And the last paragraph in the piece says, "History teaches, but it sometimes misleads. Roosevelt and Reagan had skills not fully appreciated in their times that made running a big government and being president in your 70s looked easier than they actually are for most people. Is there any evidence that either Trump or Clinton is similarly gifted?" Tom?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton has the intellectual abilities. But you can be a very smart person, and that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a good president. Jimmy Carter had the intellect of a nuclear physicist, and his presidency has not been highly rated by history. On the other hand, Ronald Reagan, who had a degree in economics but was not generally considered to be one of the brightest guys around, had 8 pretty effective years, and history has rewarded him so far. So I think Hillary has the intellectual capacity, but there's more to leadership than having the candle power.
David, I'm under pressure here to have a break, and we're going to have one, and I'll let you answer this question when we get back. I have to remind listeners that this is Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Tom DeFrank of National Journal and David Rennie of The Economist, and this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. It's amazing, these podcasts, they've really caught on. Anyway, the program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/archive/issues-in-the-news. Well, what about this presidential race? Do you see any Roosevelts and Reagans? David?
So it is hard to see either Reagan's kind of sunny optimism or Roosevelt's kind of ability to soothe the country in his sort of fireside chats. This is a very different country. It's a much more divided country. So Reagan, you know, we talk about Reagan Democrats because he managed to basically reshape the electorate. He took the white kind of factory workers who'd been members of labor unions, trade unions for years and voted Democrat on that basis. He won them over and basically kept them in the coalition. So he reshaped politics. Is it possible, and I don't know that the answer is yes, but is it possible that if Donald Trump's candidacy kind of points to a direction that the Republican Party could take after this election, will we start to talk about Clinton Republicans? Will there be a sort of a change in the coalition? Is there going to be a splintering of the white vote towards an educated versus uneducated vote. I mean, there does seem to be a gigantic split based on whether someone went to university or didn't go to university. And you see that in a bunch of other Western countries, including my own in Britain, where it's a big divide. So maybe, just potentially, there is a sort of a Reaganish turning point, a kind of pivot in the electorate potentially out there, even if these candidates don't have much in common with those two presidents.
Good point. Okay, let's turn to these Russian bombers, I think four of them, that left an airfield in David, would you hand me the Wall Street Journal there? Because I'm going to read something from the Wall Street Journal about this issue of the Russian bombers actually had been based in Iran for the first time, flew over Syria and bombed the rebels there and so on. And it's, well, the question is, how big a deal is this? And the Wall Street Journal, which I do want to read from, this is an editorial in the journal, said Russia doesn't need the Iranian airbase to bomb Syria. Russia and Iran were making a political point about their budding alliance in the Middle East. And I think the point is also that the U.S. Role in the Middle East has shrunk. Tom?
Well, I think that's right, and I think the journal is absolutely right that this was a political statement, and it is somewhat breathtaking, Fred. Even at the height of the power of the Shah of Iran, who was a durable ally of the United States, you didn't have these sorts of things. You know, I don't know what was done by intelligence agencies, but there were no American basing privileges in Iran, even when we and the Shah were very, very close. So this is quite a momentous development. And you're right, the military value here is very, very modest. But as a political statement, it's very important.
David?
I think that's right. Although I did once, the only time I've been to Tehran as a reporter, my interpreter was an ex-Iranian Air Force fighter pilot who had been trained in Texas. Flying F-4s, and, so he still had a Texas twang to his Farsi. Yeah. So it's clearly, if you are looking for signs of a shifting of the balance of power in the Middle East, and remember that Barack Obama, when Russia entered Syria last year, said we don't need to worry that this is a blow to the U.S. and its prestige, because Russia is making a terrible mistake. It's going into a quagmire. It will be bogged down. Mm-hmm. They're going to suffer immediately for this. Instead, it has to be said, if you're the Russians, although it's clearly expensive for them, it has to be said they haven't been bogged down in a quagmire yet, and they have achieved their primary goal, which is to prop up the regime of Bashar Assad, who was in a very, very poor shape last year and is now looking a lot stronger. Although we are seeing what you see, and Tom knows this as an ex-Air Force guy and covering this stuff for years, there is a limit to what you can do with bombing from the air. Mm-hmm. It's not the kind of the decisive thing that can change the shape of a civil war. So there is a sense that the bombing is getting worse and worse. We're seeing these heartbreaking images again of terrible images of bombing victims. But you can't ultimately end a civil war with bombing from the air alone. But they are...
Yeah, and if there were a quagmire, it would take the deployment of a lot of Russian troops on the ground.
Yeah, and I think President Putin is smart enough to know that. I mean, this is about power projection. Putin, he feeds on weakness or perceived weakness, and he loves being able to project the notion of a robust and muscular Russian striding across the global scene. And that's what he's doing here. And in terms of power projection and in terms of propping up an ally, Assad, it has been successful. It'll be very interesting to see what the next president, whoever he or she is going to do about Syria, because something's going to have to change vis-a-vis the U.S. role and the U.S. Whole strategic concept towards Syria and the Middle East.
And certainly this reduces the options of the next president, because even if we believe that Hillary Clinton is more hawkish than Barack Obama and would like to have no-fly zones, it's much harder now to have a no-fly zone when there are the skies full of Russian planes. You have to coordinate with the Russians. You see this reporting all the time, that in a way that the American military would not want to get into.
The State Department, this is again about the U.S. and the Iranians, the State Department, I don't want to say admitted, but they said, look, when asked, they said yes, that this $400 million in cash that was sent to the Iranians was not released to them until the three hostages held by the Iranians were actually in the air in a plane flying away from, I guess, Tehran. In any case, Republicans at least, and some others too, say, well, this means that it was ransom paid.
Well, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but the bottom line here is the optics look terrible. It looks, you know, it's the old deal of the, in Washington, if you, sometimes the appearance of conflict is worse than an actual conflict, and it may well be legally true that there was not a quid pro quo here, but it looks like ransom, and it makes you wonder exactly whether previous statements by President Obama and Secretary Kerry were exactly correct. It gives the Republicans a wonderful talking point, and they can raise the R word, ransom, whether it's true or not. So this was not a good development for the Obama administration.
David?
I think Tom is right that it looks bad and that they will call it ransom. You could make the case that it was Iran's own money that was going to go to Iran anyway, and so they actually were tough and smart and held it back. And you could imagine a President Trump in a parallel universe, if he has to send this money to Iran because of the nuclear deal and it's going anyway, thinking that it's a very Trump-like kind of tough, smart, good piece of negotiation to hold the money back until you get the guys in the air. But that's not how it's going to be sold between now and the election, I don't think.
Okay, what about Turkey? The military coup, what there was of one, was defeated. And yet the crackdown continues. What was it, a month ago? When was the coup? 3 weeks ago? I don't know. It was anyway. It's been a while. The crackdown continues. And so when 38,000 people, I think it's 38,000, Tom, were or are going to be released from prison, the immediate reaction to that in Turkey and elsewhere was, well, Erdogan, the leader, wants space in prisons for people involved in the coup that have been arrested or will be arrested.
Well, I think that's a very reasonable analysis and assessment. Tens of thousands of Turkish nationals have been detained or fired from their jobs, administrators, colleges, Supreme Court justices, lots of people. Probably the number of Turks directly implicated in the coup is probably just a couple of thousand, but many more have been are under suspicion and have been arrested or lost their jobs. And you suspect that, you know, nobody gets rid of 38,000 people 2 years early just because they want to cut down on the food costs or something.
Well, I think state media has actually said it's to free up space for the people they've arrested.
Really?
They're not concealing that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, in the beginning, they said it was overcrowding.
Yeah.
They had to get rid of that. David, what's your reaction to all this in Turkey?
Well, it's clearly a dramatic story if you're in Turkey, and that's reason enough to be discussing it.
I think that's putting it mildly.
That's reason enough to be discussing it, but let's also look at the geopolitics. We're sitting here in Washington. Turkey isn't just any country in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Turkey is a member of NATO. It's an old Cold War ally with formal defense links to the United States, other Western European powers. It is home to the gigantic airbase at Incirlik, which the Americans have used over the years as their kind of path into places like Syria, places like Iraq. And all of that puts the Americans in the most impossible position because they're very concerned about the increasingly authoritarian turn that the elected government under Recep Tayyip Erdogan has taken, the way that he is using this coup to pursue his agenda of kind of locking up his opponents. On the other hand, they can't applaud a military coup launched by the Turkish military, which was an attempt to overthrow democracy. And so they're finding themselves this gigantic country in an unbelievably important place on the map, which is part of a formal defense treaty with the United States. America looks at what's happening right now and sees no good options.
Yeah, go ahead, Tom. I was just going to say the Turks want to be members of the European Union. This does not make it easier.
No, certainly not, and it makes it much more difficult. But the Turks have a problem. David is right. The U.S. government has a problem here, and this is probably yet another of about a dozen flashpoints in the world that President Obama is probably very happy that he's not going to have to be dealing with in another 5 months or so. The next president, half a dozen more pressing issues in terms of international diplomacy will be what do we do about Turkey?
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
And if you're, and it's not just the Americans, for the Europeans in some ways even more painful. So you're right to say that for a long time now, for a couple of decades, they've been talking in theory about joining the European Union. You know, I think that's not going to happen, you know, anytime soon. But in the immediate term, Turkey is the land route that a huge number of refugees have been coming through to reach Western Europe. All those pictures we saw last summer of refugees in fields across Eastern Europe, a lot of them came through Turkey. Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, thought she had a deal with the Turks where they were going to take some of these people back or hold them there. There was going to be, in exchange, relaxing the visa rules for Turks into Europe. All of that is now agonizingly difficult, and yet the refugees are still a political problem capable of bringing down Western governments. So our leverage on a country which is going in the wrong direction is worryingly limited.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.